It's another weekly Hoytus Interruption with me, Jeff Hoyt, and our bicycle adventurers, Bruce Morser and Bob Horsley, who are riding the Great Divide Trail between Canada and Mexico. This week, they've left the Great Basin Desert of Wyoming for the Colorado High Country, and today we'll hear about steep climbs and more encounters with the always interesting characters that these guys just seem to draw to them. So,
with probably too many John Denver songs coursing through their brains to count, Bruce Morser and Bob Horsley are getting their Rocky Mountain High on somewhere in Colorado. Hi, guys.
Hey, Jeff. How are we doing?
Hi, Jeff. Yeah, highs and lows. Yeah, they're both here.
Yeah. Okay.
We're in the Alpine state.
Here. I would expect as much. Let's get the details out of the way. Where are you, and how far have you gone, and how far have you climbed?
First thing is, it's just Bob and I today. We did finally part company with Harold and Dan, although we'll probably hook Harold again. So it's just us. Mm-hmm. And the numbers are 1,650 miles close to it. And that's very close to, if not two-thirds of the way. So I think we can safely say we are two-thirds down. Mm-hmm. And probably the bigger story is that we're over 100,000 vertical.
Oh, and congratulations.
I can't tell you specifically how much the vertical is, because my meter simply stopped recording.
It was too much.
Over 100,000.
That was just too much. We're not going to go that high.
This is the last time we'll report on vertical, but over 100,000 at this point.
And where are you exactly?
We're in Silverthorne, which is close to Dillon and Frisco. It's sort of at the 70 junction. As 70 comes in from Denver, it's sort of the gathering spot and the housing area for all the ski slopes that are in the area.
Right.
It's pretty close to Breckenridge. It's a little bit north of Breckenridge, which is a place a lot of people have gone to. And specifically, though, Jeff, we are at the Luxury Inn and Suites.
Ooh.
And those words certainly apply.
They do.
We were really worried when we pulled up here. It got a little muddy out there, and we were worried about our mud spattered bicycles, like, God, we're going to the Luxury Inn. There was no need to worry.
No need to worry. It's just right there with our sweet spot with hotels.
Yeah.
Not too nice.
We just had a lovely lunch with yet another Colgate University connection. A friend of mine, Callie Cromer, came up from Boulder, where she lives, and joined us for lunch. So we've sort of stopped in town, been lunched, and now we are luxuriating in the Luxury Inn, and we're ready to talk to you, Jeff.
Excellent. Well, now you've crossed I-90, I-80, and now you're at I-70, and you'll continue on your way down to I-10. Eventually, you're going to cross that, too. After a few days in the wilderness, does crossing an interstate just feel a little surreal?
Well, it does. Today, we were on a road for the majority of the ride this morning. And it was not a pleasant experience. Cars are no fun to be around anymore. And these are big trucks. But it was a short ride, and thankfully we got that behind us.
Bob said the majority of our ride this morning, and I'm going to check for memory loss after the thing is over, but we had one burly climb this morning.
Every day has a burly climb.
That was in the picture, and more than half the time was spent on that one big, long climb today. It was a tough one.
In my conversation with Scott and Jeff, Scott mentioned that you had talked about how, with all that weight on your bike, when you guys start climbing, instead of fighting it, you just decide early on to hop off the bike and start pushing. Is that still true?
Yeah. I don't know if that's terribly accurate.
Yeah. We do have the motto of push early, push often. But what we're talking about is, like, today there was nothing even close to questionable about pushing. This was all just long, hard slog. We have had the times, and a couple of times since we've spoken with you, where you literally, it's funny, your bike goes from kind of rolling, and because of the extra weight on the bike, you hit a certain incline, and it just stops. And often those climbs, because of the steepness of them and the erosion of rain and so on, they also reveal a whole bunch of big rocks, and proceeding on by pedaling is just not going to happen. It's just out of the question. Then you do get off and have this wrestling match getting your bike up the hill.
Yeah, we had that experience a few days ago where it was probably the toughest day that we've had yet. And the top of our climb that day was walkable for about a mile and a half, but it looked like an old stream bed is the way I can describe it. A steep old stream bed.
Right.
So we walked it up the front side, we got to the back side, and it was like that for 4 miles down on the other side. And we rode it, but it was a rough ride.
Easily the hardest thing I've ever done on a bike, going up, going down. It was the most rigorous. It was the single hardest thing. We had been talking about riding through square potatoes, but this was like riding through mailboxes and car transmissions. It was just incredible in terms of the things that just plunging over. And each time you think the bike can't possibly endure this, it's going to break the front fork, it's going to taco a wheel, it's going to do something. We got to really hand it to the whole gravel bike industry, but these salsa cutthroats are just unbelievably tough, incredibly tough.
Yeah.
Now, describe for me what this is like. You're pushing your bike up the hill, you got about 80 pounds of bike and gear, but you've got wheels. Now, I'm wondering what the difference would be between putting 80 pounds on your back and walking it up and pushing your handlebars and being bent over like you would have to be to push the bike up the hill. Do you think it's easier than backpacking?
You've got both hands on both brakes. So you're pushing, but you're also ready to brake the bike in case it starts rolling on you.
If you hit like a rock, like a sharp, because there are all these sharp rocks. And if you hit a rock, it just brings this load to a stop. And then it wants to roll back. And so you have this kind of trigger on your brakes. I would much prefer putting the 80 pounds in my back and hiking. And if the bike wasn't so damn awkward, and that was an easy thing to do, I would definitely do that. It is no easy trick. And you realize that by the time you're pushing this, your hands are up over your head.
Yeah, they're over your head. That's
really
the steepness of some of these.
Yeah.
Well, and like Bruce said, I think the trick when you do this is if it's just going to be wasted energy, then it's not worth doing that to yourself.
Yeah, you quickly realize that there are some situations where you could just kind of go animal and make 50 yards by continuing to pedal, but then you'd be lying in the stream bed afterwards, gasping for life. This is no point. You so stagger your body that you'll cost yourself later on. That's not worth it.
So for our Vashon Island listeners, could you give us a sense of what road on Vashon would be comparable in pitch to what some of the things you guys have been doing? Or is there one?
It really doesn't apply because there are pitches that are not, as an average, don't seem that steep. But when you take all the car transmissions, you're pushing your bike over, that those all of a sudden, momentarily, it becomes impossibly steep. And so that they're really, it's just not analogous. It's literally, like Bob said, pushing your bike up an old stream bed or riding it down an old stream bed. There's nothing like that. It's just a get excited, bear down. It's going to hurt. You just kind of go animal and get it done.
But to try to answer your question, I would say Burma.
Burma.
the closest thing.
Yeah.
But let's put it this way. If someone said you can ride Burma Road 4 times or push your bike up that once, I'll ride Burma 4 times.
Yeah,
oh, easy. Man.
And we've had quite a few of those steep pitches where it's walkable and it's kind of ridiculous with a trail surface. In Colorado, it seems like we're getting into more classic long, big elevation. We're going to be getting into 10s and 11,000 feet here in the next few days. But it seems that most of these passes are long and stretched out in 4 to 6% grade.
That brings me to acclimation to that kind of altitude. Are you feeling like you're slowly getting there? I mean, you must be at 7 or 8 now, right?
I think we've been acclimatized.
I mean, we've been at 7 to 9 for forever.
Right.
It's up and down between 7 and 9. And we're just going to be getting into one more bracket here in the next few weeks.
It's a little hurdles you don't expect, where Bob wisely mentioned these long, smooth grades that seem to be maybe more typical of Colorado from here south. But then there'll be something like we had yesterday, where we start off and it's going to be a long, steady grade. It's a grunt. It's like Stairmaster. All of a sudden, it's not like you're necessarily breathing that hard, but it feels like you're doing several hours of Stairmaster, and you just keep pushing on. So as we're pushing up this Stairmaster hill, all of a sudden, there are all these work trucks, and they're laying new gravel and dirt, sand, on this road, and they're going back and forth with these big spray trucks, keeping everything damp. So everything is getting muddy, and it's all fresh dirt.
Not easy to ride through.
No, but wow. It's kind of cool because the guys working on the road are really, really friendly. And so they'll go by the water spray truck and they'll turn it off as they go by us and turn it back on. And they're always waving. We see them several times as we slowly march up this thing. So you do feel like you're kind of in a community chugging up this hill. Pretty cool.
Again, the theme of the trip is unpredictability. I mean, as soon as you think this is going to be an easy climb, you just have to be open to possibilities every minute of the ride.
You were in the big open, you know, in Montana and Wyoming, and then you were in the wide open in the desert, and Colorado is more of an alpine experience. Is it a complete change of topography for you guys?
Yeah, it's kind of cool. We had one day where we were chugging along, and then all of a sudden, we saw trees again. And the first trees next to the road we'd seen in a long time. So this little cluster of trees by the road, and we stopped and had lunch in the shade. And it was the first time we'd really been in the shade of a tree in a long time. And they were aspen, and it was beautiful.
Yeah, the aspen are now beginning to change because our weather, just in the past 3 or 4 days, has been the extremes have been unbelievable. We've been waking up in the morning to 20 degrees at our tent. And as soon as the sun comes up, it warms it up. But 20 degrees in the morning, and a couple of days, it's still been in the 90s late afternoon. So extreme changes in the weather. So I think the aspen are taking to the 20 degrees, and it's starting to change them. So I think by the time we get down into southern Colorado, it should be pretty spectacular.
Yeah, if we were going to put a theme to this week's phone call, it would be hot and cold.
Yeah.
The extremes are big. And I'm beginning to learn that there are two things. There's temperature hot, and then there's sun hot. So there are times where it maybe is only 60 degrees, but the sun at altitude is so glaringly brilliant that you just feel like you're dying. And there are other times where there might be a cloud that comes over and you're in the high 80s and it feels fine.
One of the things that we're starting to see now because of the season is we're starting to see hunters also. So a lot of the campgrounds have got elk hunters, and they've been great. We've had a lot of conversations with them, and they've been really helpful.
Are you guys dealing with any bumps and bruises, minor injuries that continue to nag? Have you fallen?
Who are you talking to, Jeff? Let's get
No, we're... You don't want to know. Everything's good. Everything's good, actually.
You look good, Bob.
Yeah, you look good.
You look good. Yeah.
Get that blood off the floor.
There have been some chips and dings here and there, but that, I mean, all within what you expect.
Yeah. We're coming to a point now where you're far enough along at the 2/3 mark where you should be able to kind of get a sense of when you'll finish this ride. Do you have an idea about that?
Jeff, no, I don't think we... It's way too many things can go right and wrong and all that stuff. Instead of that, let's talk about a couple of the characters we've met along the route.
Excellent.
All right, good. When we last spoke to you, Bob and I'll probably just pass the ball back and forth and the people will remember. We were in Rawlins, which is a town that's a little bit hard on its luck. And we're having breakfast in the morning, I think, right before the phone call. And a waitress there got talking to us. And you could kind of tell she was very much a member of the town and so on, and not particularly interested in us until she heard Dan, who was with us last week, and he speaks with an English accent. He's a Brit. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, she went on at great length about the royal family. And she just couldn't tell us how much she cared and was interested about the royal family. And very much wanted to engage Dan with this whole thing. And this was, of course, before the Queen died. And the whole thing was kind of remarkable.
Next night she died.
Yeah. So then, two nights later, we're in the town of Slater, which is really not a town at all. It's just a bump in the map. And we were staying. It was kind of like a mobile home park. It was designed like these old dragged-in mobile homes that were there for the hunters. And we stayed in a cabin there. And young Sarah, who was kind of running the show, all of a sudden she was engaging with us and talking with us at great length about the royal family. And was really, really interested in the whole thing. It was kind of a peek into this sort of American fascination with the royals. And now the Queen had passed and she very much wanted to engage that whole thing. She was a compelling story. She was a woman who had clearly had a hard go in life. She revealed some secrets about some of the really bad things that had happened in her family. And it was so heartwarming to see this woman had somehow escaped Denver, where all her troubles occurred. And she made it up into the mountains to work in this kind of hunting camp and surrounded herself with cats and dogs and other animals and had sort of found her place in life up here in the mountains. It was a very heartwarming story. All our spirits were lifted the next morning when we finally pushed off and said goodbye to her.
Yeah, a couple of other characters. We went through this area called Brush Mountain Lodge, which is sort of similar to the Llama Ranch in terms of its attraction to the riders because they treat you so well there. Well, they had closed it for the season because of the hunting season, and I think they let the hunters take it over for the rest of the season. But Kirsten, the owner, saw us because she lived close by, and she came down in her ATV and gave us drinks and gave us some advice about the trail ahead. And boy, I could see how if we had stayed there, we would have had a great experience. And the second one was today. We are actually in a restaurant eating with another connection of Bruce's from Colgate that's from Boulder that met us for lunch today. And we passed over Ute Pass today, and somebody mentioned to Bruce, hey, say hello to Ute Pass Steve when you're up there. And we said, oh, sure. Yeah, whatever.
Ute Pass Steve?
Ute Pass Steve. It just kind of sounded like one of these characters. So sort of brushed that off. But I'm thinking in the back of my mind that, yeah, that's kind of crazy. But I got a funny feeling about this one. And so we're in the restaurant, in this Italian restaurant in Silverthorne. And this guy comes in from outside right before we're about to leave the restaurant. And he was sort of disheveled looking. He looked more like the characters that we typically see on the trail. He came in and said, are you guys the guys with the bikes? And we said, yeah. He said, well, I live up on Ute Pass. And I said, oh, you must be Steve. He gave me a fist bump. He was like, are you kidding me? How does this happen?
He walked up and approached you. So Ute Pass Steve found you.
Yes, Ute Pass Steve found us. Yes.
The day before we meet Ute Pass Steve, we met Radium Joe. Radium Joe.
Yeah.
We had just bumped our way down an impossibly wild, one of the most wild descents we've ever been on. It was nice descent. It was largely a good road, very tight turns and kind of steep. And it was really, really kind of exciting. And we get to the bottom of this hill where the Colorado River is. We actually took a dip in the Colorado River. And there's a indicating on our map, there was supposed to be this little like convenience store. So we're kind of looking around. There's nothing that comes close to looking like a convenience store. It looks like an old ruin kind of thing, an old Western ghost town. And all of a sudden, this guy appears out of the bushes and just sort of says, yeah, I can open up the store if you're each willing to pay $12. So it's like, okay, we're in. And he said, I got ice cream. I got some candy bars. So we walk into a store. Thank goodness we got photographs of this. And it's like a display. It's not a store. It's a display case. And in the display case, there are a couple of candy bars and so on. And then there's a freezer that has a couple of ice creams in it. And this guy, Joe, and we sat on his tiny little front porch for, I don't know, almost an hour, just kicking our feet up, just shooting the breeze. And at some point, we kind of said, well, Joe, how many people actually live in Radium? He goes, two. And so it was Joe and somebody else were the full population of Radium, Colorado. We ended up spending a night in a campground down below next to the Colorado River. And it was magical because I looked at this guy's life and I thought, yikes, I'm not sure I can endure this. And he just said, I can't believe how lucky I am. I'm just the luckiest guy to be able to live here. Yeah. Pretty cool. It's really, really cool to meet these people.
The people you've met on this trip have been singularly unique, like out of a movie or something.
It's a lot like a Coen Brothers movie where you somehow enter a new phase and then there are the Coen Brothers offering you up Ute Pass Steve or Radium Joe, and it literally is, and they look kind of central cast. It is a delight. And the thing that's nice is there's so much time to kind of just go with it that you don't feel like you're rushed through this. You sit down, you put your feet up, you enjoy these conversations, and whether it's Sarah with all the cats and the royal family on her mind or Ute Pass Steve, much more than the coast-to-coast ride, really feel like we make emotional connections with these folks. And they're interdispersed with such things like one of the other connections we've made. And this is all in the last week. I stopped along the way and made connections with another old college friend, and we went to visit JJ and his family in Steamboat and spent the night there. And, you know, they couldn't have been more accommodating to Bob and myself. And, you know, made us dinner, made us breakfast, took us on excursions to fix our bikes and all those sorts of things. And it's just, they, I mean, they're living in absolute splendor. And then all of a sudden, you're hanging out with Radium Joe in incredibly simple accommodations. It is that variety, I think, that is really the true joy of things. And by the way, Bob and I are in fresh tires now.
Yeah.
Oh,
we
are
wore
you?
Out our last, yeah.
And also, by the way, failed to mention that the last two people that were in the interview, Dan and Harold, Harold is down the road ahead of us and hoping to reconnect. But Dan decided to do the route on his own just because, I mean, he's 40 years old and he wants to go a little faster.
He's on a time crunch, too.
He's on a time crunch. So he's off, and hopefully we'll see him some other time down the road if he visits us. But I think we've seen the last of Dan on this route.
Yeah.
There was a great moment with Harold. We get to Steamboat, and Harold's bike hit a big chunk of metal in the road. And immediately his rear derailleur was just screwed.
Yeah.
And fortunately, we were within, a couple miles, maybe 5 miles of a bike store. So we pull into this really funky bike store. I mean, it's really quality place. These mechanics have been working on things forever, and they really knew their stuff. And so they put Harold's bike up on the rack, and Harold's describing, this night derailleur does not work. I hit the big chunk of metal. And the guy kind of looks at it and And they both agree that, the cage on the bottom of the derailleur is really bent out of shape. And what are they going to do about that? And this mechanic on the bike just points behind Harold's head and goes, "What's that?" And Harold turns around and the guy just wails on Harold's bike. He just broad palms the derailleur and just smacks it. And then when Harold looks back with this big noise, it's the thing is working perfectly. He's like, "They're fixed."
It just needed an adjustment.
This is marvelous stuff.
So I wonder about the future for you guys. You're having such a great time on these gravel bikes. Will road biking still hold its appeal for you after an experience like this?
For me, not. No.
On Vashon, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean,
it'll be fun to ride on Vashon.
But I'll still probably ride my gravel bike on Vashon on the roads. Mm-hmm. It's just a more comfortable bike.
Yeah.
It is so nice to not even worry about where you go. I mean, with trucks and so on, I just automatically leave the road and I don't worry about whether the bike's going to be up to it. I can just sort of plunge off the road to get away from the truck that's passing and so on. And I can just pull right back on. So I'm with Bob. I think he's right that even on Vashon, I'll probably ride the gravel bike more than the road bike.
Yeah, these bikes have just been remarkable.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's just they're awesome. Yeah.
So you are heading beyond I-70 and heading south. I guess that's toward what, Aspen? What?
Heading south. We're Salida. Not going to Aspen. We're going to Salida, and then we're going to be in the southwestern. I believe it's the San Juan Mountains in southwestern Colorado.
Yeah. All right.
Our next phone call with you might be from New Mexico.
Oh, yeah. Excellent! And I wish you safe travels.
All right, Jeff.
Thank you much, Jeff.
Bruce Morser and Bob Horsley from Silverthorne, Colorado. It seems every week I think of a question I wish I'd asked, and this week's regret was that I failed to ask them what they were doing on September 10th, which was the day back here on Vashon Island that the bike ride Bruce and Bob helped create, Passport to Pain, was sending 300 riders out onto the gnarliest hills the island has to offer. We have three different routes for P2P. The 30-miler is the Weenie, the 50-miler is the Weasel, and the 80-miler, with 10,000 feet of vertical gain, is the Idiot. So which of those three did they do on the day P2P was actually happening back here? Bruce told me later that every day is different. One day they're a Weenie, the next an Idiot, and a Weasel the day after that, which, from their descriptions of the various conditions they're encountering, sounds about right. You can access all of our conversations from the homepage at voiceofvashon.org. We'll be back with another episode of Bruce and Bob Ride the Divide a week from today. Till then, that's Hoytus Interruptus. I'm Jeff Hoyt.